This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars episode 49 was recorded on August 26th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. All-star Jeff Snyder from Alhambra Investments is back, and it wouldn't be Jeff Snyder without the slide deck. So listeners, be sure to go to macrovoices.com. You'll find the download link if you're a registered user on our homepage next to Jeff's picture. If you're not a registered user, just look for the red button that says looking for the downloads in order to get the excellent slide deck which accompanies today's interview. Jeff, after our last interview, we were talking off the air about gold and the dollar. Now, generally speaking, the consensus view is that when the dollar is up, that's usually bad for gold. But over the last several months, we've seen the dollar and gold rise together. My sense is that that caught at least a few of us off guard. I'm certainly certain that it caught me off guard. So what is it that's driving gold higher at the same time that the dollar is rising as well?
Well, Eric, the short answer is interest rates, and that's really what interests me the most, pardon the pun. The behavior of gold is similar to what we see in global bond markets, and ultimately, they are being driven by, you know, the same factors. So if it's all right with you, Eric, why don't we always begin where I want to begin, and that's with the curves.
No surprise there. And it's certainly a very topical place to start because we now have not just the twos tens curve, the 2 year to 10 year, but also the 3 month to 10 year parts of the yield curve are inverted. So everything's inverted and suddenly everybody's a bond watcher. Put the word recession out there and suddenly everybody's ears perk up. And now people are starting to pay a little bit more attention. So what's going on here?
Yeah, it's a really a shame too, because, you know, as you and I have talked about for a while, both on Macro Voices podcast and off, there's so much more information contained in all of the curves, not just the yield curve, because there are other curves as well. But if you're just going off of the yield curve, you knew way back in 2017 it wasn't going the way everyone said it was. As we see on slide three, you know, there was supposed to have been this growth acceleration, an inflationary breakout worldwide, which central bankers in particular were pitching because they really, really wanted to cover themselves in glory. They wanted to stand up and say, hey, it may have taken us a lot longer than we said, but we finally did it. Here's the recovery we've been promising you. See, our genius monetary programs do really work. And the yield curve all along said, nope, it's not happening. The flat yield curve in 2017 and throughout 2018 was the bond market reigning all over the parade before it ever got started. And you and I talked about this pretty early on last year, but the public doesn't ever hear about bonds and curves. They only ever hear what Janet Yellen or Jay Powell has to say or what they think. So if we go to slide four, now there's this recession warning, and it seems like it's sprung up totally out of the blue. And people are asking, where did this come from?
Right, because the yield curve, as everyone knows, has a great track record in predicting recessions. However, I'm going to take the other side of that argument for just a moment. A lot of analysts have spent the last year writing and saying, wait a minute, this time really is kind of different because we've got $15 trillion of negative yielding debt around the world. So, Jeff, is it this vortex of negative rates that's what's pulling down long yields in the U.S., or is there something else at work here?
Well, there's been a lot of yield curve denying going on, yield curve denial, however you want to call it, especially now that the public part of the curve, for lack of a better term, has inverted. And there are several theories about why this time must be different. You know, one study published by a couple of Fed researchers recently claimed that the lingering effects of QE in the U.S. are responsible for, you know, maybe 70 basis points at the long end. That is, you know, yields are 70 basis points lower than they otherwise would have been without that long ago QE. What has a lot of people talking now is the proliferation, as you pointed out, the proliferation of negative yields all over the rest of the world. And the idea as it relates to treasury yields is that they are an equivalent alternative. That is the same risk profile, but much, much higher return. A German 10-year bond yielding minus 70 basis points doesn't seem particularly attractive compared to a 10-year U.S. Treasury yielding even 1.5%.
Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? If you have a choice, why sit there and buy only German bunds at deeper and deeper negative yields when you can put your investment money somewhere else? As you said, the credit risks are comparable, and I'm sure there are ways to manage any currency risk from dollar swaps and so forth.
Sure, it's plausible, but why are German bonds or whomever else is that are negative to begin with? You know, why are negative yields spreading to so many places? That's the question nobody ever asks. We're supposed to just assume it's Germany's problems, not ours. As if the world is a bunch of separated and isolated financial islands, each one being driven individually by their own idiosyncrasies.
Well, and that raises a good point that our listeners have asked about quite a bit, which is negative yields. They don't seem to make any logical sense at all. It's hard for people to wrap their heads around why any sane person, let alone professional investors who seem to be doing most of the buying here, why would a sane person who presumably wants to maximize their returns essentially pay the government a fee for the privilege of lending it money that they might inflate the value of away before they pay it back? I mean, that just doesn't seem to make any logical sense. What's the missing point that nobody's seeing here that explains this?
Well, the issue of negative yields, and I run across this a lot too, it's just one of perspective. And what I mean by that is you and I and all the listeners, we look at these sovereign bonds from the standpoint of investors. I mean, they are bonds, meaning to all of us, they're really an investment choice. Nobody forces us to buy them, which means someone out there is choosing to buy them at prices where they are guaranteed to lose money, at least on the interest component. But where you and I and all our listeners, you know, we aren't the only class of potential investors or the potential people who are interested in these things. In fact, I would point out there is far less of you and me in the sovereign bond market than there is this other group.
Okay, this other group. Who is this other group and why don't they seem to care whether or not they make any return whatsoever? Why are they willing to pay a fee for the privilege of lending money to someone? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's the global banking system. Financial institutions who have very different uses for especially the highest tier of sovereign issues. Again, to you and me, these are investments. To the global bank, it is nothing more than a balance sheet tool. The interest rate, negative or not, is not a return for them. It's a relative measure of cost. How much does it cost the bank to hold these tools relative to more risky activities they would otherwise engage in? So even a negative yielding sovereign bond has utility on a balance sheet. Now, the value of that utility is determined by its function, which is managing a specific kind of financial risk, in this case, liquidity risk. These are liquidity tools, and the opportunity cost of holding them is nothing more than a liquidity premium that banks are obviously willing to pay when they believe it is worth it. Therefore, the lower and even more negative the yield, the higher that liquidity premium or cost gets to be. And so you need to ask yourself, not from the standpoint of an investor, but from the standpoint of someone who understands this other world, what is it that would make banks willingly pay a higher and higher cost for managing liquidity risk?
Well, you say, I need to think about it not as an investor. Frankly, I want to think about it as an investor. As an investor, I'm very concerned if the banking system, who presumably are people who know more than me in a lot of cases, are so worried that they seem to be needing this insurance policy so badly that they're willing to do seemingly crazy things in order to get it, paying money for the privilege of lending money to the government. So what you're saying is that these sovereign bonds are really just an insurance policy against a liquidity event, and that the banking system is signing up to pay higher and higher premiums for that insurance policy or policies. That would mean that the banking system must be perceiving higher and higher liquidity risks. But Jeff, the point that I feel like I'm missing here is these are banks. They've got vaults. Why would they pay a premium for the privilege of getting a bond instead of just taking cash out of the system and putting it in the vault that they already own?
Well, look, there's a couple different ways this works. I mean, you know, how exactly do these sovereign bonds function as liquidity insurance? One is simply the negative correlation to price. You know, things go bad in a liquidity crisis, people tend to ditch risky assets and illiquid assets and flee to safety. Things like U.S. Treasuries and German bonds, which we all expect will rise in price when things go bad. So there's the negative correlation in price. It's a hedge. But beyond simple price hedging, and get to your point about, you know, why don't they use cash, sovereigns are highly dependable in repo. So they are like collateral insurance, or more accurately, collateral reserves. The way balance sheets are constructed and operated, you know, I'm just going to briefly illustrate it on slide 5 here. in the environment we've been in since August 2007, banks have been made to think about all of these weaknesses in balance sheet design, especially when it comes to funding and liabilities. And repo is at the center of pretty much everything. Now, as much as I want to, you know, to get back and forth with this discussion about repo and negative yields and how they fit into balance sheet tools and balance sheet design, we're not going to be able to get into the details today. But I promise you, there is method to what seems like madness.
Okay, so if the banks were to just take cash out of the system and put it in their vault, they don't end up with an asset which appreciates when the rest of the world panics even more, which bonds would appreciate in price on further panic. And they don't end up with an instrument that they can repo if they need to, you know, the music's playing, they got to get up and play this game that they know how to play. They can't do that if the cash is in the vault. They need bonds that they can work through the repo system. I want to make a quick note to our listeners, as has become almost a standard practice when Jeff is on. We're going to also have some links on our homepage at macrovoices.com next to Jeff's picture with some additional content, other articles which Jeff has written, which go into more detail on these subjects than we have time to cover in today's interview. But getting back to today's interview, let's tie this back in to the U.S. Treasury yield curve. I noticed that when the Treasury curve inverted, Janet Yellen popped up and said, "Nothing to see here." Something about structural differences in the Treasury market making it a much less reliable signal. Well, she ought to know. She kind of corrupted the Treasury market over the last decade. So if she says it's not a reliable signal, I'm inclined to believe that. Was this global banking perspective the thing that she was missing?
Yeah, I think, you know, Janet Yellen's a perfect example of what I mean by yield curve denial. Let's go to slide 6. It's a very human phenomenon that, you know, the thing that just, it just can't be what it appears to be. In the case of the yield curve, it's a matter of expectations, right? I mean, Janet Yellen, like Jay Powell said, explosive growth, inflation, all this stuff is coming. You know, 2008 was going to be really good, but 2019 was going to be even better. You know, that was the whole crux of what I called inflation hysteria, which is most, you know, the public believed that because they heard economists and officials over and over said this was a done deal. You know, acceleration, growth, recovery, all that good stuff. You know, that's why the Fed was hiking rates to begin with. And then we get to 2019, and it's turning out not to just be disappointing, you know, a little disappointing, but as the year drags on, we see more and more the complete opposite. You know, we have a slowdown, probably a downturn, maybe even a recession. And now even a global recession isn't out of the question. And so Janet Yellen says, no way, that can't be. There's no possible way we've gotten this so wrong. And so that's why, to her, the yield curve denial, they're all stunned trying to process how that could be at the same time covering their behinds as much as they can. Yeah, you know, that's just what the yield curve has been saying, not just in the U.S., but all these sovereign bond markets. The inflationary breakout scenario Janet Yellen and everyone in the public eye had in mind was always a low probability outcome. The higher probability, according to the yield curve and the other curves, like the Eurodollar futures curves, was just what we see happening.
Okay, but Yellen didn't just claim that the yield curve was wrong and leave it at that. She gave a couple of specific reasons. She said that they were structural. I know she mentioned term premiums, which is something central bankers and economists like to talk about a lot. And I know that you've gone over this before on Macro Voices, but for the benefit of our listeners, could you quickly remind us what term premiums are, or at least what economists mean when they refer to that term, and why is Janet talking about them in the context of what's going on now?
Okay, slide 7 and 8. Economists divide an interest rate into three parts. A bond yield is a combination of inflation expectations, the expected path of short-term interest rates, and finally, these things called term premiums. Inflation expectations, that's pretty straightforward. The path of short-term interest rates is a little more fuzzy and more interesting, but essentially, it's what monetary policy will look like in the future. And I should note here that it doesn't mean what the Fed thinks it will be doing in the future. Rather, it is what the market believes the Fed will be able to do, regardless of what the Fed thinks it wants to do. And then the last section is term premiums, which in the official definition is supposed to be what a bond investor demands for loaning someone money for a longer period of time. If the U.S. government wants my money for 2 years, they have to pay me X. If the U.S. government wants my money for 3 years, it'll have to pay me the 2-year rate plus a little extra. That little extra is the so-called term premium.
Janet Yellen pointed to negative term premiums as one reason for why we shouldn't listen to the inverted yield curve. Is that the issue? And she's not the only one. So why would she and so many economists point to this explanation if it wasn't true in some way?
Well, the reason they talk about term premiums is simply because QE didn't work. I mean, that's not what everyone thought Ben Bernanke was talking about when he started QE in the beginning. I mean, meaning that the standard for success was a real recovery, not some obscure embedded interest rate calculation. If you don't have the real recovery and you can't talk about one as having justified QE, then you're stuck trying to fool everyone into buying term premiums as the last-ditch standard. Well, maybe, you know, we'll still try to make it seem like there's some evidence that it worked. What Janet Yellen and other economists see is what they want to see. You know, go back to the 2017 scenario. The economy, they said, is still going to take off. There will be inflation, and that will mean the Fed will be raising rates to tame that. And these are all very good things. But if that was all true, bond yields would have gone way up, and they would still be rising, like the right-hand side of you, what you see on slide 9. That was the whole premise behind the slogan, interest rates have nowhere to go but up. But interest rates aren't rising. They never really did, which is why the yield curve flattened so much, even when all of this seemed the most plausible in public. So how does she explain yields that weren't really rising to begin with, and now how they are falling? Simple. We go to slide 10. She says that the markets still expect higher inflation, still expect higher short-term interest rates, but because of other things like R-star, something that they talk about a lot, or this lingering QE effect, by process of elimination, to Janet Yellen, it has to be lower term premiums or even negative term premiums that are the reason for lower yields. In her view, one that is shared at the current Fed, the market is still very positive about inflation and still very positive about rate hikes. So it has to be term premiums. Why? Because that's what she thinks. And she nor any other economist will accept that they might be dead wrong about this and that the bond market totally, completely disagrees with her view.
Okay, so what you're saying is that Janet Yellen and other people who think like her are basically projecting their own views onto the bond market, and they're rationalizing term premium as the justification for why it must be true that they really are right, even though the bond market appears to be trading more and more in the opposite direction of what they seem to be expecting.
Yeah, here's the real kicker. We don't have to observe, you know, we don't have any way to observe term premiums. They're entirely made up, and economists only come up with the estimates for them through these convoluted statistical calculations. On the other hand, if you go to slides 11 and 12, we actually have robust and deep markets for both inflation expectations as well as the anticipated path of short-term interest rates. The first is simply tips and inflation break-evens, and the second is Eurodollar futures. We don't need to calculate what the market is thinking about these things. We can just check the market prices for them.
It's not looking so good for Janet Yellen's term premiums then, if I'm reading your charts right. The TIPS market seems to be saying, first, there really wasn't much inflation risk before, and now inflation expectations are falling pretty sharply. And of course, we're talking about monetary inflation. What happens in the real economy that affects prices is almost a different story. Eurodollar futures are up, in fact, way up in price. And I know that that means the market is expecting lower short-term interest rates in the near future. And all of that would suggest falling bond yields are due to reduced expectations for inflation, as well as short-term interest rates, regardless of what unobservable, poorly defined term premiums might be doing. Is that the essence of it?
Yeah, exactly. And really what you need to do, you need to ask yourself, what is it that would drive the bond market toward lower inflation expectations and lower short-term interest rates? And it sounds like textbook deflationary pressures, because it is textbook deflationary pressures. And what is another way to describe deflation risk? Liquidity risk. In other words, it's the very same thing that is driving German bunds negative. It's the same thing that's showing up not just as lower U.S. Treasury yields, but also as these important pieces inside of them. Global liquidity risk, which you and I, Eric, we've already talked about that extensively, including how the dollar surprised so many people by moving higher when under the inflationary scenario, many were expecting it to dive much lower.
Right. That was the baseline, so to speak, for many people heading into 2018. But let's bring this all back to the original question. Maybe the dollar caught some people off guard, but what about gold, Jeff, in 2019? It's supposed to be higher dollar, lower gold. Only this year, it's modestly higher dollar and much, much higher gold. Deflation, as you're describing it, now that shouldn't be good for gold, which is conventionally an inflation hedge.
Well, not in all cases. You know, slide 13, we need only look back to 2008 to see one of them. And there are times, there are other times too. Gold is the ultimate hedge, period. Inflation, yes, but also a hedge against profound instability of all kinds. Now, that could mean like 2010 and 2011, for example, whether or not the euro survives. When the world is highly, highly uncertain, there will be a demand for gold for all of its beautiful historic reasons. But like a negative yielding sovereign bond, there are costs to hedging using gold. Now, these are opportunity costs mostly. And the biggest one is that gold doesn't pay any interest. And so the cost of holding gold relates to the general interest rate environment. And if the general interest rate environment is believed to be heading much, much lower or deeper and deeper negative in some parts, the opportunity costs of hedging via gold should go way, way down. If you go to slides 14 and 15, in other words, what I'm saying here, as this broad global sense of deflation becomes more and more accepted, you know, the higher probability scenario that the market is pricing out, that means liquidity risk, which manifests in the extreme demand for balance sheet tools, as well as the constituent parts of the interest rates. So not only does the instability make gold more attractive on the demand side as a hedge, the perceived or expected trend in interest rates also seriously reduces the functional cost of carrying it as a hedge. So when gold turned higher, that wasn't term premiums either. It was the gold market essentially agreeing with the bond market on where rates are going, as well as what that likely means for the world.
Jeff, before we close, I want to come back to this issue of rates going lower. Now, suddenly the euro-dollar futures, the long euro-dollar futures trade has come into vogue. And those people who think that we're going to see lower treasury yields, the lower interest rates generally, seem to have suddenly, you know, these are the guys that were just bond bulls. They wanted to be long duration, and particularly 10 and 30 year treasuries, because that's where the biggest bang for the buck was. They seem to have changed horses, and now they love the long euro dollar futures trade. Now, I think, if I understand it correctly, Eurodollar futures has much more to do with a bet on short-term interest rates than long-term interest rates. So what's going on here? And I guess what I'm trying to weigh is, on the one hand, it seems like this trade's coming into vogue. There's some smart people that have been advocating it in the last 2 or 3 weeks. But you also said that it's moved a really long way already. Maybe it's overdone and due for a big pullback. So give us a little bit of perspective on why would someone make a bet that interest rates are moving lower using a long position on Eurodollar futures as opposed to treasury bonds or another conventional measure? What's the difference? Why would they trade it that way? What are they trying to get out of it? And what's your view in terms of whether that makes sense or not?
Well, Eric, you're right to point out these are two different parts of the curve. You know, treasury bonds are the long end, and Eurodollar futures are an instrument to trade about what's supposed to be going to happen at the short end. So, you know, they're separate parts of the curve, and they're related in what the investors are seeing at both ends. But what we're seeing in Eurodollar futures is essentially the next step after what happened in the inverted yield curve. In other words, what is going to happen now that if we think the economy is falling, there's global recession risk, there's liquidity event risk, those things have risen. And now that the yield curve is somewhat inverted, what is the next step? And people are starting to think about, well, obviously what the next step is the Fed starts to realize that these things are actually happening after denying them as much as possible. We're going to get to a point where the Fed's not going to be able to deny reality much longer. What will happen at that point is what always happens at that point. The Fed starts cutting benchmark interest rates furiously. And so if you're long Eurodollar futures, that's a bet in your favor because you're betting on lower short-term interest rates in the future. And if you're right about the way the long bond and the curve inversion is going to work out, eventually the Fed will agree with you. So you're actually getting in ahead of the Federal Reserve before it sees what you already see.
And I suppose the counterargument would be if you believe Jay Powell, who said, hey, guys, we're not starting a rate cutting cycle. This is just a mid-cycle adjustment. There's more rate hikes to come. If there really are more rate hikes to come, then you'd take a beating if you were long Eurodollar futures, correct?
Oh, you get killed. But that's the thing. And, you know, the old adage is don't fight the Fed. When in the bond market, you get paid a lot to fight the Fed because the Fed is usually very wrong about most of these things.
Well, Jeff, we're going to need to leave it there. But before I let you go, when you're not giving us insights on the Eurodollar system here on Macro Voices, you're the chief investment officer for Alhambra Investments, a retail investment advisor in Florida. For our listeners who'd like to follow what you do there and learn more about Alhambra, please tell them how to do so.
Well, I'm usually at alhambrapartners.com. I post a lot of in-depth and detailed stuff about the Eurodollar system. My partners talk a lot about investing and portfolio management. And like you said, we offer portfolio management services using a very unique technique and a very unique view of the world.
Well, Jeff, I can't thank you enough for another fantastic interview. We look forward to getting you back on in a couple of weeks for another update. Meanwhile, listeners, we've still got Professor Steve Keen coming this week on All Stars, as well as part two of our Summer Monetary Policy Special featuring Danielle DiMartino Booth and Peter Bookfar. So keep it tuned to macrovoices.com for a whole bunch of exciting content coming up later on this week. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.